Access number 30408, Major Bob Godfrey, Reel 15. Now, your next move in September is you're posted to the 4th Battalion Royal Anglian Regiment.
That's
now,
right.
They're not the Suffolk, are they? They're another body in disguise.
They really were originally the 1st Battalion Royal Leicester Regiment. But the Royal Leicesters were swallowed up into the East Anglian Brigade, and thereby the brigade became Anglian. We lost the East. Somebody discovered there were not only East Angles, but there were Middle Angles as well. And so we called ourselves the Anglians. Still to this day on the television, we're often called the Anglicans. But we were Royal Anglians, and I was to be a company commander in the 4th Battalion. It's a matter of interest. It was at the moment that the Royal Leicesters became Royal Anglian. They were very disgruntled. They were not happy about losing their identity as the Royal Leicester Regiment, based in Leicestershire, you know. They felt totally out on a limb from East Anglians, and all the rest of us were East Anglians. And remember, by now, obviously, we are completely regular regiments, so we're all recruited from our recruiting area, so we were all East Anglian. They were unhappy about it. One of the ways of overcoming it was to post out from the Royal Anglians, post out from the Royal Leicesters, all the company commanders and the CO, and to bring in a CO from a former East Anglian regiment, and all the company commanders were from former East Anglian regiments, and I was one of them, obviously. Again, this didn't particularly help with the soldiers or all the RSM, etc., and it was not an easy time for them, and it was less difficult from our point of view, I suppose. From the we were the incomers into that, the aim being to assimilate into the Royal Anglians this new battalion.
Now, where were they when you joined them?
They were based at a strange camp at Watchet, just outside Minehead in Somerset.
So was it called Watchet Camp?
Watchet Camp, yes. Yeah. Now, I can't remember what its origin was, but it was, I think it was a, may have been a, I don't know. It's may
now,
have been
what was your role as company commander, in view of the fact that you were an outsider, almost sent in? I mean, how did you carry out your role?
I had...
do you remember which company it was?
Yes, I do. It was C Company. I always seemed to be with C Company, yeah. My Sergeant Major was a Sergeant Major Pierce, Royal Leicester. And my colour sergeant was colour sergeant Parkinson, a Royal Leicester, though he came from Lincolnshire, but he'd been a Royal Leicester. Both of those men had served with the Royal Leicesters as junior ranks in Korea.
Now, how did you get on with them? Because that could have been a make-or-break relationship.
It was, and I worked hard on it, and we got on really very well indeed, extremely well. They were very good men.
Was there an initial resentment, do you think?
They did it very well. They performed immaculately. They were good old soldiers, those two. Very good men. The men of the battalion, there were some very good ones among them, but a lot of them were... And I think everybody, original Royal Leicesters as well, would accept this. They were fearful of losing their regiment because of recruiting numbers. That was effectively it. If they had, if the Midland Brigade had been able to recruit more strongly, they would have stayed. But it was just that they were not able to recruit. And over the 2 years leading up to this amalgamation, when they were fighting not to amalgamate, they recruited a very, I can only say, moderate quality of man to join the regiment. And that led to quite a lot of trouble, discipline trouble and so on. But it was it worked out well enough.
What kind of discipline problems?
Well, there was quite a lot of drink, a certain amount of pilfering, a certain amount of absence without leave. I mean, nothing I think I can recall court martial offences.
So it's low grade discipline problems. But more than you'd... I mean, there's obviously odd cases of all these things, isn't
there? Oh, yes, of course.
But more than you were used to, say, within the East Anglian regiment or within the Suffolks.
Yes, I think that's right. I wouldn't... You know, I certainly don't want to be critical of the Royal Leicesters because they were... The core of that regiment were very good, obviously. But they'd gone through terrible struggles and times. They came begrudgingly to amalgamation with the East Anglian regiments. And I think the recruiting helps to explain part of the trouble.
Now, what were you doing at Watchet? Or was it just...
It was very temporary, because I arrived on the 27th of September, and on the 24th of November, we flew the whole battalion and flew to Malta.
Now, what was this deployment?
In Malta?
Yeah, which camp in Malta?
It was in St Patrick's Barracks in Malta, which was a major barrack system. It was extraordinary. It was, unlike most barracks, it was one enormous barrack block which held the whole battalion of soldiers. Almost a complete battalion's worth of soldiers. It was huge. I can't remember how many stories high it was.
Was it old or new?
Oh, God, I would think early 20th century, I suppose, late 19th century, possibly. It was at the end of a whole set of barracks and so on, the main military enclave in Malta.
Was it a comfortable barracks or was it...
No, it was comfortable. It was pretty cold and miserable in the winter when it rained. I mean, you don't often get a lot of rain in Malta, but surprisingly, you know, the Mediterranean gets its share in the winter. And all of the terraces were open and the rain would come in. It was okay. It was comfortable enough, I guess. The men were fairly well housed. I mean, we were extremely well housed, the married officers. There were a whole set of brand new or virtually new quarters just beyond the barracks. But
Got that, what, in November?
Yeah.
Was this seen as a plum posting? What was your role of the unit there? Or was it just occupying?
It was providing part of the military organization within the Mediterranean. It was providing the jumping off point for training in North Africa in desert warfare. And so we had landing ship tank LSTs to take us over. We went either as companies or as battalions over to Libya in order to carry out desert warfare training. My first visit to the desert, very interesting, intriguing, and I was a company commander, and I went with great pleasure to do these exercises.
Now, what were these desert warfare? I mean, it's almost the obverse of jungle. I mean, jungles, you can't see anything. In a desert, you can see everything.
You learn to drive by sun compasses, and you learn to choose routes carefully. You learn that all movement except the very final movement, if you were doing assaults on a minor scale, all movement done in vehicles, especially adapted vehicles. The GOC Malta, the army commander in Malta, was a chap called General Frost, who distinguished himself as a parachute battalion commander.
Is that Sir John Frost?
That's John Frost, yes. Yep. And he was a great chap for getting us all out into the desert, you know, and designing special vehicles and so on. He was an amusing man.
I mean, did you meet him? Did he have an impact on the battalion?
Oh, yeah, very much so, yes. I met him on one occasion when I did a very neat right hook with my company on vehicles, and I drove round behind the enemy position, and there he was standing up in his Land Rover, and I had a sort of a disagreement with him, because he said, "You are not supposed to be here," and I explained that I was only carrying out the orders of the, you know, that I'd been given by my CO, and he said, "Well, then your company's written off, you shouldn't be here." You know, we had a slight argument about it, on the best of terms, really, but then, I mean, it sounds rather, the way I'm describing it sounded rather pathetic, but I think what we were doing was learning to live in the desert, another terrain to try and master.
Now, how do you live in the desert? I mean, what is the
art? Well, you need lots of blankets for night time. You need to be able to bivouac down. You need to be very careful over your use of water. And you have to be able to keep yourself dry if you're there in the winter, because it does rain. Everybody's idea of the desert is that it's boiling sun forever, and it's not. So anyway, I went during the period I was with the 4th Battalion in Malta. I went on several exercises to North Africa, always sailing from Malta to Benghazi, which was the main British base remaining in Libya. We're talking about 1965.
Late 65, into 66, from the looks of it.
Yeah.
Anything happen?
Well, I had two interesting things. One, I had to take my company to Tripoli, which is the capital of Libya, because the British Army was leaving Tripoli. It was still before the day of Colonel Gaddafi, but he was very much on the horizon, and the British were removing themselves from Libya. Their main organization, army-wise, had been in Tripoli, and I had to send, my company was sent over there soon after we arrived in Malta to provide the necessary guard facility for the final months of evacuation, or maybe it was 6 weeks of evacuation of the British garrison. So that was a humdrum routine guarding situation where we had to appoint guards for various areas and so on, and to maintain those guards until the very last British soldier and piece of equipment had left Tripoli.
Now there wasn't a question of you being attacked. It was just
It was a precaution. Yes, just sort of.
Was there any unrest? Was there any unrest in Tripoli?
No, there wasn't at that time. No. That all came after we had evacuated, when the Americans had an air base there, and they still had an air base at the time that Gaddafi seized power, but they withdrew soon after that.
So you're in Tripoli.
For about 6 weeks.
That, presumably, as you say, was quite dull in a sense.
Yeah, the routine. We were living in the Ordnance Depot barracks, which is where the final stores were withdrawn to, as it were.
And it was just C Company?
Just C Company, yeah.
And what you said there were two. What was the other?
The other was after the Tripoli Libya adventure, we went back and as far as I remember now, it was January, February, yes, 9th of January 67 until the 26th of March 67, I took my company to Aden, our task was to guard again the final withdrawal of the British from Aden, which took place at that very time in 67. Company was flown, it was a series of companies flew from Malta and or Cyprus to Aden during those final months of the wind down. And our job was to protect, was to provide a guard for RAF Corps Maxar, which was the main RAF base, the main airfield at Aden. Corps Maxar, I think K-H-O-R-M-A-K-S-A-R, Corps Maxar. So that was more interesting because Aden was a more interesting place than Tripoli.
Was there more trouble there as well?
There was, at the time I was there, there was very little trouble. Much of the trouble had gone. There'd been a lot of trouble beforehand. And the, as far as I recall, the Argyll and Sutherland's on MAD under command of MAD Mike Mitchell, which stole the national headlines during uprisings and in the crater district of Aden, had happened before, so we knew that it could happen, but it wasn't happening. I think that was mainly because by the time I got there with my company, it was apparent to the local people that the British were on the way out, were leaving. So I was there, as I said, from the 9th of January till 26th of March, back to then back to Malta.
Anything happening during that deployment to Aden then? Or was it just a more interesting environment than...
A more interesting environment. I also, we had military detachments up in, up country in Aden, in the Protectorate of Aden, and I managed to fly out to visit some of those detachments, really simply to escape the boredom of patrolling and I of guarding the RAF station. We had 24-hour guards, and normally we were able to take an odd couple of soldiers with us as a relief, if you like, to fly up country in these great Beverly, RAF Beverly transport aircraft. As to how we ran our organisation, we our guards were divided into the company was split up to provide guards in a certain way, and they had to do 2 days guard and 1 day off, and the guards were 24-hour guards, as I remember, and the myself, my second in command, my company sergeant major, and my colour sergeant, we took turn about to be responsible for the guard, usually half a day each, so that there was room for visiting guards without being responsible for them on other days, and also the general routine administrative necessities. But it was an interesting period, and it didn't go on for very long, so I think I was happy enough for it to come to a conclusion, though I enjoyed it while I was there.
Were you actually there on the final moments of the pullout, or had you already left?
No, another company came and oversaw the final thing. I was very close to the end. Virtually everything had closed down, but for the RAF base on which we were deployed.
So back to Malta?
Back to Malta, and back to Malta from 26th of March, back to Malta. Time enough, I think, for a couple of exercises in Benghazi, which we still were had the use of. The eastern end, if you like, of the eastern part of Libya was still British at this stage. And an exercise or so, I can't remember, I don't remember the dates of all the exercises, in North Africa. And then on the 26th of June, returned to the depot Royal Anglian on 26th of June 1967.
So quite a long posting.
Yeah, it was nearly
2 years.
Well,
again,
2 years plus, yeah.
So what next? Back to the depot?
Next, back to the depot, still in Berry. And on the 27th of July, taken on strength Brixmas for the my final army tour.
So that's 7th of July, 67.
27th of July, 67.
It was still, Brixmas is still the British commission.
Commanders-in-Chief of the Soviet forces, yeah.
Were you in the same capacity?
No, well, I was instead of being the captain touring officer, I was the major touring officer, G2, grade 2 touring officer, and still doing occasional.
So GSO2 as opposed to GSO 3, yes.
Yeah, in those days, that's what we were, yeah. Yep. And so the same routine continued.
Were you based in the same place?
Yes, based in the same place. I'd never described it, but the officers of Brixmas were sitting in the main headquarters building of British forces in Berlin. It was, in fact, the main administrative building of the 1934 Olympics. Was it 34 Olympics, I think? The Olympic Stadium, everything were British military at that stage.
And it was a big, imposing building.
Oh, imposing building with great Aryan statues in every direction, yeah. And we had excellent quarters. The officers lived in very good accommodation. We had lots of help in the home still. It was a continued throwback to the arrangements immediately post-war, really, in terms of the German economy paying for the occupying force.
Now, what about had the role changed? I mean, it's a few years later. Had things moved on a bit, or?
I think they had. I mean, indeed it had changed from when I was first there. I mean, the main change, I have to say, and I didn't describe it originally in my first, when we were talking about my first posting to Berlin, the main change really then was in 1961, in August 61, when the Berlin Wall went up.
That's my fault as well. I should have asked you what impact. Tell me about the impact that had had.
Yeah, I mean, we're jumping back now, as you realise, but the first thing is, one has to say with absolute certainty that it took the Western Allies completely by surprise. Not that I'm particularly important, but in fact it happened to be that our younger son was 6 weeks old and our elder son was 2.5, and my wife and I were spending the weekend touring around. Occasionally families went off to fly the British flag throughout East Germany. And we spent a night in, we spent the Friday night in Leipzig. We then drove down to Dresden, and then we moved across to Weimar to spend the second night, the Saturday night. We didn't notice anything unusual during our journey through East Germany. On Sunday morning, when we woke up, the hotel manager made a point of coming to me and saying, in perfect English, the Hotel Elephant is of Weimar, is a famous from 18th century, from Goethe and so on, and the classical times, romantic period of German literature. And he said, "I think, sir, that you should make your way back to Berlin. I think there are going to be problems." And this was the first intimation that I had that something untoward was happening.
And this was, what month was this up?
This was exactly, it was Sunday morning, August the 13th, 1961. It's embedded in my memory forever. So we set out and we got halfway back to Berlin, and lo and behold, now, on this day, every road was full of military traffic. East German and Russian traffic, but mainly East German. We got halfway back and we were detained by a German detachment who forced us over into Parkplatz. I refused to speak to him. I said, I wish to speak to a Russian officer. Russian officer came. In the end, I followed him to his Kommandantur in Halle, where I was interviewed by the colonel of the colonel commandant of the Russian forces in Halle, asked what I was doing, and I said I was on a holiday with my family. And he said, then you should make your way back immediately to Potsdam, which is our headquarters. And he let me go off, and I went and drove on to Potsdam. It was only on arrival in Potsdam that I learnt that, in fact, the East Germans had sealed off the centre of Berlin. Berlin had, since the war, been divided into four sectors of Allied occupation: the French, the British, and the American, largely on the western part, and the Soviet zone of sector of occupation on the east. It had always been surrounded and separated from East Germany by a wall, if you like, but the wall that everybody speaks of from August 1961 was a wall that came to be built between the Russian sector of Berlin and the three Western Allies. The reason for that was that East Germans could get into the Soviet sector of Berlin, usually without too much difficulty. They could, until August the 13th, 1961, walk across into the Western Allies sectors of occupation, go to the nearest soldier and say, please fly me to West Germany. And they said, well, you know, they were sent off to, it was a hive of activity. It was a constant stream of East Germans seeking refuge through our auspices in West Germany. So the East Germans said, this is it. We're not going any further. We are going to stop it. So that was the wall, and that was when we didn't know that it was going to happen. The construction of the barrier between the West and the East, Berlin, was seen by the West as being a possible reason for aggressive retaliation. But when the Russians said, well, you know, you can send as many of your soldiers into East Berlin as you like, what's changed? And there was very little argument against that in principle. The free movement of the Allies within the four sectors of Berlin was perpetuated.
So it was just that the civilians couldn't.
Civilians couldn't move across, yes.
But this erection of the Berlin Wall had not stopped you in any way from doing your job back in your first posting?
No, absolutely not, no. And then when I came back the second time, it was the same situation. We could still travel freely to East Berlin, and we, Bricksmith and the other Allied missions, could travel within the limitations of the imposed restricted areas, could travel freely in East Germany, and we continued to do so. We continued a heavy system of vehicle patrolling in East Germany, the coordinated now, I think, more carefully between the three Western Allied missions, so that we didn't flood one area and leave another totally denuded of our vehicle patrols.
So the British, US and French missions?
British, US and French, yes.
Would cooperate?
Yes,